Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Today I'm going to be talking about the second week of a four-part series. Today I'll be talking about the authenticity and addressing the skeptical arguments. Weeks 3 and 4, that's been scheduled in November, and so we will get to that in a few months. We had to schedule in a couple of high-name speakers in there. But just a plug-in for Gary Habermas. Gary Habermas, I would consider pretty much the world's authority on the resurrection of Jesus. So make sure you come for him. So we are very, very honored. I'm not even sure how we were able to get him, but he's an incredible person. I'm going to quickly review what we talked about last week. I know that some people were not here, so we'll just quickly go through this. There's a lot of information. So I'm going to talk about the features of the shroud that I talked about. First of all, we talked about the shroud is actually a photographic negative, and that was discovered when someone took a picture of this in 1898. They developed it, and when you look at a photographic negative plate, it is more discernible than the actual image that you would see with the eyes. So what that means is there's some sort of photographic negative effect on this shroud. There's also 3D encoding on the shroud, and so not only is this a 2D image, you can actually process this, and it can reveal 3D information inside that shroud. The image is only on the topmost fibers. So within a yarn of a linen yarn, there are around 200 fibers inside a yarn. And the image is only on the top 1, 2, 3 fibers of a yarn. And in a single fiber, the discoloring is only on the circumference of a fiber. There is no discoloring inside of a fiber. The blood is still red, even after 2,000 years, or even if you believe it was medieval, it's still red. There is no body image under the bloodstains. So what that means is that the bloodstains came on the cloth first, and then the image was applied on top of that. We talked about the halftone effect. You have to stand about 10 feet away from the shroud to truly discern the image. Farther than that, you can't really tell because the image is very, very faint. Closer than that, it's hard to discern because it's comprised of like dots. So just like if you look at any photographic image on a newspaper, if you get really close, all you see is dots and you can't discern the image. This is the same effect with the shroud. It is also hyper-realistic. Doctors can analyze this and make medical judgments based on the body. There's an airbrush effect. What that means is that there is no paint strokes on the shroud. And the only way I can think of that to replicate that is using an airbrush type effect. The nail is through the wrist. So if you look at the art in history, all of the art depicts the crucifixion as a nail going through the palm of the hand. Whereas on the shroud, it is depicted as going through the wrist. And now we understand that is more medically accurate, going through the wrist than through the center of the palm. Dislocation of the shoulder. There's also, if you look at the shroud, his right shoulder is a little bit lowered, and his right arm is longer. And the doctors have analyzed this and discovered that the man on the shroud had a dislocated shoulder. We have scourge marks all over the body. This is also contrary to artwork. We see scourge marks covering the entire front and back of the entire body. We have a crown of thorns. This is also contrary to artwork. Typical artwork, you have a laurel crown of thorns. On the shroud, it is not a laurel. It is more like a cap of thorns. We see the side wound on the shroud. On the bloodstains, there is no evidence of any breakage or smearing. So if you put a Band-Aid on a bloodstain and then you tore it off and you look at the Band-Aid, you will see some breakage or smearing on your Band-Aid. But on the Shroud of Turin, there is no sign of that. We see facial wounds. There are no broken bones. The body is in a state of rigor mortis. And so doctors can determine this by the shape of the muscle. All the muscles are rounded. Nothing is flattened. There's no signs of any decomposition on the shroud. It is a fine linen cloth with a herringbone weave. We talked a little about the side strip. The side strip, you can see it. Maybe I'll show a little picture of it later. But there is a side strip that is cut from the main piece of the shroud, probably about 3 inches wide, and has been sewn back on. That is referred to as a side strip. Banding means when you look at the yarn through, I think, transmitted light, the fabric of the yarn hasn't been bleached uniformly. So some of it is a little bit darker than the rest. So that just shows you that this was actually created probably around the first century rather than medieval times, when they had a better technology to dye to bleach the yarn. There is angle encoding. This is a little bit more difficult to explain, but you can see this because there are no ears on the man of the shroud. Now, if it was an artist, you'd say, okay, can't this person paint ears? But there's no ears there. There's also no thumbs. And I explained that through angle encoding. What that means is if the part of the body is towards the side, the imaging mechanism is not able to capture that. And so it depends on the angle of the cloth relative to the body. So if it is more of an angle, there's less imaging. You can also see that in the gradient of the size of the body. There's also like an X-ray effect. So you can see sort of like the fingers, the bone fingers, and you can also sort of make out the teeth. The measurements of the shroud is 8 by 2 cubits, and that matches the Assyrian cubit length. There are shoulder abrasions. There are blood serum retraction rings. There is blood of type AB. In addition to the scourge marks, there are whip marks. There are calcium particles on the feet that match the Jerusalem area. And there has been a DNA analysis showing that the DNA of the people, most of those people are centered around the Middle East. So that's quickly going through what I talked about last week. Today, what I'm going to be talking about and trying to argue is it is more reasonable to believe the shroud is authentic compared to being a medieval fake. And hopefully I'll convince all of you of this at the end of the day. Now, I will not be proving with 100% confidence that the shroud is authentic. I'm simply showing that it is more reasonable to believe it is authentic than a forgery. So we have two main views. We have, number one, it's a medieval fake produced by an artist. Number two, it's a first century burial shroud of a crucified man from Jerusalem. So what I will be doing this morning is I will be attacking position number one, and I will be defending position number two. So let me attack the medieval fake argument. So number one, this was the conclusion of the 1978 Sturt findings, that it is not artwork. Quote, no pigments, paints, dyes, or stains have been found on the fibrils. It is not the product of an artist. So remember, the Sturp team, they went to Turin, Italy, and they studied the shroud for 5 days. They subjected it to a lot of scientific tests, and their conclusion was, it is not the product of an artist. Number two, for the most part, there is silence from the art community, art museums, art books, art classes, and art journals on the Shroud of Turin. How many people have gone to an art museum and seen the Shroud of Turin? One. If it is a work of art, why is it not in any art museum, talked about in art museums, art books, art classes? It doesn't make any sense. And I mentioned last week, I did visit a museum that has a shroud in it, but that was the Museum of Funeral History. I'd highly recommend going there. Number three, several have tried to replicate the shroud image, and have not succeeded. They've only attempted to replicate the body image itself, and they have not been able to fully replicate it. And to my knowledge, I haven't seen anyone try to replicate both the blood stains and the body image. So no one's even tried to do that. So that'd be very strange if someone from 1350 was able to create this, and we are not able to replicate it at all. Number four, this is the top evidence cited by skeptics, the 1988 carbon-14 dating. And I will be talking about this in depth a little bit later, because this is very, very important to talk about. Number five, for completeness, there are other arguments for it being a medieval fake. Two of them are the DRC memo and Walter McCrone, that's him pictured right there, and paint particles that he found on the shroud. I am not going to be talking about that today, but if you want to look at that, you can look at my website, defendingchristianity.com. I cover this in depth. Okay, I'm going to talk about the arguments for the authenticity of the shroud. One, as I mentioned last week, the shroud is the most scientifically studied artifact. And it wouldn't make any sense if it was a medieval artwork and it being the most scientifically studied artifact. And what I like about this is you can find a lot of peer-reviewed articles in secular journals about this. As I mentioned last week, I like to argue about other things like the global flood. And it's very, very hard to find any peer-reviewed articles on the global flood in any secular journal. Whereas with the Shroud of Turin, all the articles that I found that are peer-reviewed are in secular journals. And you can read a lot of those on shroud.com. That's Barry Schwartz's website. Very, very informative website. STIRP concluded that an actual body was involved. So in their official report, it says, "We can conclude for now that the shroud image is that of a real human form of a scourged, crucified man." The features of the shroud predate the use of art techniques by hundreds of years. Hyperrealism was not even used in artwork until after the invention of photography. They tried to replicate photographs and try to create hyper-realistic art. This was hundreds of years after the medieval times. Halftone. Halftone was only invented because of trying to put pictures in printed documents. And so the way that they do the halftone is just make a whole bunch of dots, and then they can make it look like a picture. This was also invented hundreds of years afterwards. The airbrush technique, that was also invented hundreds of years afterwards. Features of the shroud predate scientific discoveries by hundreds of years. We talked about photography, 3D imaging, X-rays, UV imaging. It is only because of these technologies that we are able to truly understand the shroud. Without these technologies, we wouldn't even discover the 3D effect, the photographic negative effect, or some of the X-rays or UV imaging. The image in blood have features we cannot fully explain. So we have no idea how to explain why is the image only on the topmost fibers. We can't fully explain why is it the fibers are discolored. Remember, there is nothing added to the shroud to make this body image. The body image is simply because the fibers are discolored. The blood is still red. No one can fully account for that. And there is no image under the blood stains. Now, we have partial explanations for all of these, but to my knowledge, there is no complete explanation for any of these. Features depicted are contrary to artwork and instead depict how it should have actually happened. We see this in the scourging. We see this through the nail through the wrist, as I talked about. Barbet did experiments and tried to crucify cadavers by putting a nail through the palm, and it would not hold up. It was only by the Shroud of Turin that we're saying, hey, it seems like we have to put the nail through the wrist, and Barbet confirmed this. the crown of thorns. The crown of thorns makes sense because in the artwork, you have this very nice crown of thorns, and it would have probably taken a Roman soldier quite a while to knit that together. I mean, do you think a soldier is actually going to spend that much time making a crown of thorns? Probably what he did was he just simply lopped off some crown of thorns, put it in a bunch, and then just stuck it on his head and just pounded it in. Abrasions. The Gospels do not talk about abrasion marks, and yet we see the abrasions through the UV lighting. It is anatomically perfect, and there is rigor mortis with the body. The features of the shroud point to first century Jerusalem origin. The dimensions of the cloth match the Assyrian cubit. The side strip seam matches the Masada seam. So I talked about the side strip. The side strip was cut off at one point in time, and then later in the history of the shroud, it was reattached. And that seam is found in first century Masada. Banding is not seen in medieval weaving, but in ancient weaving. There's calcium particles on the feet that match Jerusalem. The wide-angle X-ray scattering points to first century, and DNA analysis has organic remains centered in the Middle East. I want to talk about the carbon-14 dating. So in their official report in 1989, they said, the results of radiocarbon measurements at Arizona, Oxford, and Zurich yield a calibrated calendar age range with at least 90% confidence for the linen of the shroud of Turin of AD 1260 to 1390. The results, therefore, provide conclusive evidence that the linen of the shroud of Turin is medieval. So what they claim is that this is conclusive evidence. And after they published this, pretty much the research all in the shroud just died off. Even STIRP members said, okay, well, they proved it. It's a fake. And a lot of the STIRP members stopped research, and they believed the 1989 carbon-14 dating results. And even to this day, most people still believe this. So I'm going to have two main counter-arguments to the carbon-14 dating. One is the entire carbon-14 testing procedure was flawed. Two, the carbon-14 sample that they took was not representative of the entire shroud. So I'm going to go into details about both of these. First of all, if you're going to do carbon-14 testing, you would like to take several samples in several different places, and they only took one sample, one place, top left corner. And so if that was off, you have nothing else to fall back on. Originally, they were going to have seven labs involved, but they ultimately decided to only have three labs involved. And this is a quote from the carbon-14 scientists. Of course, there was one from one of the seven that got kicked out. But it says, if one of the laboratories pulls out, then the test will be virtually meaningless. As you are aware, there are many critics in the world who will scrutinize these measurements in great detail, the abandonment of the original protocol, and the decision to proceed with only three laboratories will certainly enhance the skepticism of these critics. And this was from the carbon-14 scientists. This is a picture of how they portrayed the shroud when the Savoy family owned it. So the Savoy family, they owned the shroud for hundreds of years, and every year they display the shroud to the public. And the way they displayed it is like this. They held the shroud, and they just hold it like this, and on the top corners and at the top. And so they sampled it at one of the most contaminated parts of the shroud. So if you're going to do carbon-14 tests, you would want to pick it a spot where it's not contaminated. But this was one of the most contaminated spots. blind testing was not done. So if you are going to do any tests, you would like to do a blind test. So, for instance, if you're going to test some experimental drug and you give it to someone, you're not going to tell them, oh, this is the actual drug. Oh, no, I'm giving you the placebo. No, I'm giving you the actual drug. You know, they're not going to do that. You need to have blind studies where you give someone medicine and they don't know if it's the actual drug or if it's a placebo. In this case, everybody knew which sample was the shroud of Turin. How did they know that? Because of the herringbone weave. No other sample that they had had a herringbone weave in it. The only sample that they had that had a herringbone weave was obviously the shroud of Turin. And so they did not do any blind tests. Even though they did not physically tell them, oh, this is the shroud of Turin, it is so obvious. So it was not truly blind. They were supposed to film the entire procedure for documentation purposes with a video recording. However, there was one point in which they stopped the video recording. And that was when they actually put the shroud sample inside the vials before they shipped it off. Everything else was filmed, except for the most critical part. And they did that in a separate room. So they cut it, and a few people went into another room, and they put it into the vials, and they came back out, and then they held the vials. They could not explain why they went into a separate room to do that. And they also could not explain why they did not video record that. There was inconsistent weight samples. So on the top there is the weight when they actually cut it and then they weighed it. They put it into the vials. The labs got the vials. They weighed it again. And there's discrepancies between the weights when they had cut it and when the labs received it. Nobody can explain why are there discrepancies. There was improper pretreatment. The labs were supposed to photograph and weigh the samples, but they didn't really do that either. The testing was not confidential. So if you're going to do a study, you do not want to release your results prior to it being officially published. So it was supposed to be published in 1989 by Nature. Nature was going to gather all the data from all the different labs, produce the final report, and then submit it and release it to the public. However, in October 13th of 88, there was a BBC report on this, even before it was officially reported by Nature in 1989. So obviously somebody leaked the data. There was a conflict of interest. Edward Hall was the head of the Oxford lab, one of the three labs that did the testing. He was a trustee of the British Museum. The British Museum was the organization that was going to get all the results from all the three labs, and they would collate all the data. Now, so there's a conflict of interest here. He was a trustee of the British Museum, and he was also head of the Oxford lab. And the timing of all this is also very interesting. When Oxford did their testing, Arizona began their testing on April 25th and completed their testing on June 8th and submitted their data to the British Museum. Oxford began their pretreatment on July 4th, a month later, and then completed the testing on August 8th. So Edward Hall probably could have had access to this data since he was a trustee of the British Museum. Later, Edward Hall admitted, frankly, I think it was a hopeless prospect to keep the results secret. You couldn't with the best will in the world. When you do scientific experiments and produce a paper, you're supposed to release all of your raw data to the scientific community so they can verify it. But they did not do that. They hid all of their raw data. It was only 27 years later when Tristan Casabianco, who was a lawyer, used the Freedom of Information Act to compel the British Museum to finally release their data. This was in 2017. So that's very suspicious. Why did they hide their data? And the reason is, once you look at the data, we find out that they manipulated their data. So you can see the data here, and I have to use my laser pointer here. And sorry, it's not very bright, but this right here, this part right here, is the part that they did not report. They dropped that data. So the top part is, let's just look at the top part. Zurich submitted their data, that top part, but right below that is all of their data. So they dropped some of the dates. And Oxford, they didn't drop any of their dates. What they gathered, they reported. And then Arizona, they dropped some of their dates as well. So the top one is what they reported. The bottom is the dates that they collected. So two of the labs dropped some of their dates that they had. So the question is, why did they do that? So the best explanation I can think about this is sort of like an analogy. Suppose we have two people and we're going to weigh them. We'll take three measurements, one on Monday, one on Tuesday, and one on Wednesday. So let's just measure the weights of Ed first. On Monday, he weighs 150 pounds. On Tuesday, he weighs 151 pounds. On Wednesday, he weighs 152 pounds. Sounds reasonable. Let's weigh Walter. He weighs 140 pounds on Monday. On Tuesday, he weighs 185 pounds. And on Wednesday, he weighs 230 pounds. That sounds unreasonable, right? So the question is, what makes the second one unreasonable and the first one reasonable?
Time factor,
probability. Yes, probability.
Limits,
yeah. And so they did the same thing with the data. And you can determine the significance level based on the raw data using statistics. I don't know any about that, but I'm just giving you the analysis. And they had three control samples and then the shroud. With the control samples, one of them had a 90% significance level, another one with a 50%, and another one with a 30%. The higher the number, the more reliable the numbers are. With the shroud, they had a 5% significance level. What do you think is the cutoff in order to be accepted as a valid result? 5%. So they coincidentally happened to meet that level, right? Only if they drop certain data. If they included all the data, it would be below 5%. Because they dropped some of that data, they squeaked in and achieved the 5% significance level. That is why they dropped the data. So the summary of the procedural violations: it was only tested at a single sample area. Only three labs did the test. It was sampled from one of the most contaminated sections. Blind testing was not done. Putting the samples in a separate room was not filmed. The sample weights were not consistent. The labs were not rigorous in carrying out the initial steps. The labs did not have independent testing. There was a conflict of interest. The raw data was kept hidden for over 27 years, and we have evidence of the manipulation of the C14 data. So I can't even think of something that they did right with the carbon-14 testing. Second main argument is, the sample that they took was not representative of the entire shroud. So the entire shroud is supposed to be made out of linen. You're not supposed to make anything mixed with linen and wool. This was an Old Testament law. And so when they studied the shroud in 1978, they didn't detect really any cotton in the shroud because they studied the main part of it. All they had was linen. But the C14 sample that they took contained both linen and cotton. This was theorized by Sue Benford and Joe Marino in 2000. Sue Benford was actually the one who theorized this as a husband and wife. She was a nurse, and she looked at the photograph, and she said, something looks weird about this weave. It just looks different. And so they submitted this sample of this photograph to three textile experts. They did not tell them where the sample came from. And all those textile experts said, yeah, something is different about this. And one of them theorized that it was an invisible reweave. What that means is that they can weave some more material into this and make it invisible. Ray Rogers, who was the lead chemist of STIRP, he thought this was just a crackpot idea, and he said, okay, I'm going to disprove this. And so he studied this. He had an actual sample from the raised corner, and he studied it, and he confirmed their hypothesis. He discovered cotton in that sample that he had. Later, he was actually able to get some of the reserve samples from the carbon-14 area and confirm this scientifically. He published a paper in Thermochemical Acta in 2004 and published his results. Robert Villarreal also confirmed this, that the sample was not homogeneous. John Brown from Georgia Tech also confirmed this. And this photograph here is one of the cotton yarns. And you can see those two white marks right there. That is when one yarn crossed another. And the dye did not get applied at that point. And so this is tangible evidence that there was cotton and it was dyed. Gilbert Reyes, when he had cut it from the shroud in 1973, at that point, he had already noticed that there was cotton in his sample. And even from the official 1988 C14 report, they said there was cotton found on the shroud sample. This is the quad mosaic imaging, and on the bottom left-hand corner is where the sample was taken from. You can see chemically it's different from the main part of the shroud. It is green over in the bottom left-hand corner, and the rest of the shroud is orange, yellow. What this shows is that it is chemically different at the sample that they took it from. So those are my two main counterarguments. The entire C14 testing procedure was flawed. It was a, quote, scientific mistrial. So even if they dated it to the first century, we'd have to throw it out because the procedures were violated. So it doesn't matter what date that they have. The procedures were totally flawed. Also, we have evidence that the sample was heterogeneous and it contained material other than linen. So therefore, the conclusion is the 1988 C14 dating can be considered invalid. Next, I want to talk to some scriptural religious objections, and we covered some of this last week. One, the shroud is a graven image. Two, the shroud is just another Catholic relic. Three, the Gospels state there was linen clothes, plural. The man in the shroud has long hair, which is forbidden by Paul. The prophecies say the man's beard was plucked. All right, the graven image. Exodus 20:4-5. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. So graven image in the Hebrew is pesel, and it means a carved wood or stone statue or sculpture. So this is something that is made by man, and typically, back then, it was referring specifically to something that was carved. And we're commanded not to make a statue and worship it. Now, if it is authentic, then it's not made by man. So it's not a graven image. If it's a fake, then it could be a graven image because it was made by man. So I'm not claiming it's a fake. I'm claiming it's real. So in that case, it's not really a graven image. Okay, it was just another Catholic relic. Okay, what is a relic? A relic is an object or article of religious significance from the past that usually consists of the physical remains or personal effects of a saint or other person preserved for the purpose of veneration or a tangible memorial. Now, technically, the Shroud of Turin is not a relic. It doesn't really fit into this definition. Technically, it is an icon. It is an image. But we can call it either an icon or an image. Catholics do not worship icons or relics. They can only worship God. Relics can be venerated, but relics cannot be worshipped. So it is a misconception by those outside of the Catholic Church that Catholics worship relics. And even I had that misconception prior to doing research on this. And what's interesting is in 787, in the Council of Nicaea, Second Council of Nicaea, they said that all Catholic churches should have relics. And so then during the medieval times, every single Catholic church had a relic. At a minimum, one. Most of them had a lot. As I mentioned last week, the Catholic Church has no position on the Shroud of Turin, whether it is authentic or fake. The linen clothes, plural, John 19:40, it says, they took the body of Jesus and wound it in linen cloths with the spices as the manner of Jews is to bury. And so the argument is, we only see one piece of the Shroud of Turin, there's just one. Why is it plural? Well, the reason is because of the side strip I was talking about. The headcloth also, but with the side strip, this was cut at one point in time. And then later, it was sewn back together. Now, someone also mentioned about the headcloth, the sudarium, that can also count as another piece of cloth. So we have 2-3 pieces of cloth inside the tomb. And this is John Jackson. He was the founder of STIRP, and he theorizes that side strip is used to bind and wound around the entire body with that side strip. The straw man has long hair, which is forbidden by Paul. This argument is not used a whole lot, but it is used. In 1 Corinthians 11:14, it says, does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a dishonor to him? Now, first of all, Paul wrote this many years after the resurrection. And obviously, Jesus could not have read what Paul had wrote, so he couldn't have violated this. But we also have to look at the context of the passage. The context of the passage is about authority. I don't think Paul was giving here a treatise on, okay, how long people's hair should be. He was just using that as an example to illustrate authority. And we see this in the expanded version Bible. It says, even does not nature or custom culture itself teaches you that wearing long hair is shameful for a man? The Greco-Roman men normally wore their hair short, but long hair is a woman's glory. Long hair is given to her as a covering. So he was specifically writing this to a Greco-Roman audience who had short hair. And so they understood the context of what he was talking about. So he was applying this argument from their culture. Also, we have examples of people in the Old Testament having long hair. Samson had long hair. Absalom had long hair. And also, I believe Paul had long hair at one point too. In Acts 18:18, and I'm not going to read all that, but at the very end, it says, having shorn his head, for he had a vow. What vow is that? Most likely, it was a Nazirite vow. So we have Old Testament evidence, and we have New Testament evidence about long hair. Prophecies say the man's beard was plucked, and this prophecy is in Isaiah 56. And we see this missing part of the beard at the very bottom. So his beard was probably plucked. So in conclusion, as far as I can tell, there is no viable evidence demonstrating the shroud is a medieval fake. And I've been trying to do a lot of research on all the skeptical arguments, and I haven't found one of them that is held up. All evidence points to its authenticity. Therefore, it is more reasonable to conclude the Shroud of Turin is the authentic burial cloth of a crucified man from first century Jerusalem than it being a medieval fake. Now, notice I have not concluded it is Jesus of Nazareth. It could potentially be any crucified Jerusalem male in the first century. And in week three, I will be arguing why it is Jesus Christ. And weeks three and four have been scheduled for November, so be sure to come on back and hear my final arguments. I'll open up for questions. We have about 10, 15 minutes.
Oh, gee, I've got the microphone. How about that? Before I hand it off, significance of the Assyrian cubit, was it the measure of time and place? What was the nature of the contamination of the samples and the significance? And what's the possible role of the spices included? So those were my questions.
Oh, wow.
I was paying attention, man.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Oliver, I'm over here. I really appreciate all of this. I mean, I've been very ignorant of the shroud and haven't been paying a lot of attention to it, but this is a lot of good stuff to learn. I appreciate all your work on it, and you are a brave man for what you've gotten into today. I got one question, though, and we have found out over COVID that the whole concept of science is kind of a flexible thing. Oh, I see everybody laughs in the room. They see that, too. It's become clearer to us that it's become more of an agenda, depending on who's doing the science. Now, I believe in science, but what do we do with all of this? And this is a kind of an apologetic question. What do we do with all of this when we're moving into a day and age where people do not believe in truth anymore?
Okay. Very good question. Well, I can even throw in the Bible. A lot of people don't even believe in the Bible anymore. But if you go into the secular world, science carries authority. And I specifically selected my scientific evidence that both the pro-shroud people and the skeptics accept. There is very little dispute in any of the scientific evidence that I've been producing by anybody. So the majority of the skeptics and pretty much all of the authenticists accept all the scientific evidence that I've been producing. So I've been very selective in the evidence. There's some evidence that I have not been presenting, which is commonly cited by the authenticists. And by the way, a way to describe the authenticists is the shroudies, like a Trekkie, so I'm going to say shroudies. The shroudies, some of the shroudies say that they cite the pollen evidence and also the coin over the eyes. I do not use that as evidence because that is disputed by the skeptics. So there's a lot of evidence like that. So I've been very selective in the scientific evidence that I've been presenting.
My question is related to what you just mentioned. I've been a shroudie since 1979, since the original study. when I heard in 1988 about sea carbon 14 dating, it occurred to me that maybe a
couple... Before I go on too far, we only have 10 minutes, so everyone ask your question in less than 1 minute.
Okay, please. A group of people may have conspired to corrupt the data to suppress the truth. It just occurred to me, but I didn't believe it. But now after 2020 election, when the, this big tech and government conspired to suppress the truth to the public, now it is entirely possible. Just, I just want to comment on that.
Yeah, I've been trying to come at from this from a scientific point of view. So all of my arguments, I've tried to very hard just to use the scientific arguments and not to use any other forms of arguments. So quickly, I see a lot of hands, so we're going to have to go through this really quick. Somebody was over
here. Oh, I have a question. It might be a dumb one, but like when we're looking at the shroud, what are the little objects on the side? It's like looking at X-ray and you can't quite see everything. When we see Jesus's face, and then when you really can't see it, the shroud has little objects on the side, like it could have a hip bone connected to the knee. I don't know, but just wondering what those.
Yeah. Okay. Here's a replica of the shroud right here.
Yes. Yes.
And these are burn marks on the side.
Okay.
1532. That's the first thing that you see. That is not the body image. The body image is this very faint thing in the center here. And you can see his face right here. This is his entire front of his body. And then this is the entire back of his body. So we see, and these horizontal lines here are crease marks. And yeah, these are repairs done by the Poor Clare nuns after the 1532 fire. And there's some water stains as well. So his body image is very faint. And I'll leave this up here if anybody wants to come take a look at it later.
Thank you.
Okay.
Oliver, on the data that was deleted, you had the range of dates was nothing like 1200 to 1300. It was like 500 to 800.
Yeah, that's before the present. So in carbon 14 dating,
prior.
They always
okay, thanks.
They always use before the present.
Hang on, Bob, coming.
And then if we have time, we will answer all of Marty's questions.
Oliver, I have known Roman Catholics who did worship idols and images, not that the church has a position on that necessarily, but the Roman Catholic Church has also now venerated Mary as more than an intercessor, also a co-redemptress with Christ, which is blasphemy, plus many other things.
Yeah.
But if God has forbidden imagery in any form, like the ephod that Gideon created, as I mentioned last week, if God is not for imagery, and he gave us no description anywhere of himself, or except in the book of Revelation of the resurrected Christ in symbolic form, if God is not for imagery, there's another angle of this. Could it have been produced supernaturally, demonically even?
Oh.
Never thought about that, but
if
God is not for imagery.
Yeah. I haven't heard that as a possible theory, so I haven't seen anyone argue that way.
Right, right.
Yeah,
I can agree with everything scientifically and what you found.
Yeah.
I just think, is there a purpose?
Yeah.
I mean, if we'd seen the face of Jesus, we'd say, wow, I've never seen that before.
Yeah.
The face of Jesus.
Yeah, let me just address this in a general sense. I realize this is very controversial, and that's why I approach this first from a scientific point of view, because really it's going to be hard to dispute this from a science point of view. And so there's a lot of baggage if we approach it in other ways, like, especially if you approach this from a Roman Catholic view, they have their own slant towards this. So I'm not trying to approach this from any particular either Roman Catholic view or even a Protestant view. I'm approaching this mostly from a science view. Questions? If there's no other questions, and then I'll address Marty's questions. We still got 7 minutes, right?
Yeah, I've got another person coming behind you.
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
go ahead.
Yes. But
well, take your shot. Go ahead.
Yes.
Okay. My question is, what would be the motivation of the Carbon 14 guys to try to falsely say that it's not from first century?
Okay. When they did this test, the carbon-14 dating testing, it was a new method called AMS. And they wanted to, they had financial reasons to make sure to show the public and the world, the scientific world, that AMS was a reliable dating technique. So if they failed at this, AMS would not have taken off. So AMS as a dating technique took off right after this. So they had...
Wouldn't that have been the case even if they said it was from the first century?
But my point is addressing why did they fake the numbers? Why did they drop it so that it passed that 5% significance level? And let me add to that also. I've heard skeptic arguments say, well, even if they dropped the data, it still doesn't point to the first century. That is correct. Even if they dropped all that data, that's only a few years. They're still 1,300 years off. So that is not my argument. That's not the point. The point is, why did they drop that data? And the point is, if they didn't drop the data, it would have totally invalidated the test, and they would not have been able to make any assessment on the shroud.
Oliver, how confident are you of carbon dating, even if it's done properly?
Oh, that's a very good question. Actually, I am more confident of the carbon-14 dating than the scientists themselves because I take their values literally. I said, yes, I believe those dates that you gave me. What's interesting about it is if you actually take those dates, the dates go younger and younger as you go closer to the center of the cloth. There's a linear correlation. And that does not make any sense. And so there's peer-reviewed articles on this trying to account for that, and they say there was contamination. And say, well, is there any evidence that there's contamination? I mean, they didn't do the cleaning correctly. Is there any evidence that they didn't do the cleaning correctly? And I'm just saying, these are the top labs in the world. And they don't know how to clean. So I take their values literally and say there is a linear correlation. It is not a result of lack of cleaning. And so there's other theories about to explain why is there a linear correlation. So the Dead Sea Scrolls were also carbon-14 dated. I accept that as well. So personally, I do accept carbon-14 dating. And there's other arguments as well.
Maybe this is a silly question. When I look at a picture, I can say that's Caucasian, that's Asian, that's Middle Eastern. Does that picture that we saw give any evidence of ethnicity?
Some people do claim that. I'm not that great in determining someone's from the Middle East by looking at a picture, but some people do claim that. Marty's questions. You had a list of three questions?
Yes. The chemical compositions of the spices, the significance of the units of measure, and who remembers what my third question was?
Okay, let me answer those two first.
Go ahead.
The units of measure of the cubit. The cubit was not used in the Middle Ages. So someone who created this in the Middle Ages must have known about the length of a cubit and created it like this. So the forger would have tried to do everything as possible. Let's just study the first century, to study everything and replicate everything from the first century. And the spices, allicin spices. Yes, there's 100 pounds of allicin spices that was brought in by Joseph of Arimathea. But from the reading that I've done, I can't really determine what they did with that. So they could have applied it to the body. They could have applied it on top of the shroud. They could have, you know, wrapped the shroud around it and then put the on top of the shroud. Or they could have just left it on the side, because we know that Mary had to come back later to finish the burial process. So we don't know what exactly Joseph of Arimathea did during that first time. Mary had to come back later to complete it. So we don't know exactly what got completed. And there's a third question.
Nature of the contamination. You showed the guys holding up the shroud like a banner.
Yeah.
And the guy, somebody apparently holding it in that very corner.
Yes.
What possible contamination could that have contributed?
Oh, yeah. Even if you had thousands of people holding it, it's not going to push the date from medieval back to the first century. My only point is, if you're going to do carbon-14 testing, you do not want to select a contaminated spot. Now, I have a personal theory about this. It related to the invisible reweave. Because it was held there, there was a lot of use of this, and people were touching it, and it probably damaged that shroud at that location. And so they did that invisible reweave to fix that. And I believe that it was in 1578 that it was permanently displayed in the Turin Cathedral, and they no longer held it. And I believe that was when they actually fixed it with the invisible reweave, and they stopped holding it at that point. So that's my own personal theory. All right.
We good?
10-10. All right. Thank you very much. And weeks 3 and 4, November.
Do we have to buy tickets for that?
See, Bob.
Thank you so much. I find this stuff fascinating. I really do. I was listening to somebody on the radio not long ago, and we were talking about, quote, the inconsistencies between what we call science today and what God's Word says. And they said, well, just wait and allow science enough time to catch up, and they'll figure it out. One second, please. Check my notes here. We'd like to introduce Penny Johnson. Penny, come on up. Penny is here to introduce a new endeavor. And let me allow her to make her way up, and I'll give her the microphone.
Never used a microphone, so. Thank you. My name is Penny Johnson, and I'm very excited and terrified at the number that showed up today. But just the chance to share the vision of this ministry with you is exciting for me. What is Angel Wear? You've already got a visual aid in front of you. Technically, it's a ministry that makes and donates burial gowns to families that have suffered the loss of a child before, during, or shortly after birth. These gowns are created by volunteers who use donated wedding dresses. Very simple concept. But how did I get involved in it? A few years ago, I owned a bridal shop in Virginia. And after a fall, I was told that I was going to have some back surgery, and I was going to require a lengthy recovery. So I closed my shop, sold my house, and moved in with my daughter, specifically in her basement. Because this happened rather quickly, I just brought the inventory from the store and put it in storage. I had heard of groups using wedding dresses to make bereavement gowns for babies, and every time I thought about it, the word angel wear popped into my mind. But every time I said, I had this objection, I don't sew. I kept hearing the question, exactly what are your plans for those dresses? I'm sure some of you have heard a voice asking questions, and we often find ourselves too busy to realize that that incoming message could be for us. The storage unit raised my monthly rate. I reacted by going over there and pulling all the gowns out and putting them in my daughter's basement. She gave me grace. Then I broke my wrist. As I began physical therapy, I realized that I could do some of the therapy at home. God moment beginning. So I began disassembling the gowns. My first fear was, how do we do this? I was becoming an expert at tearing these gowns apart, but I'm still not a seamstress. We don't have to invent the wheel. There are groups that have been doing this ministry for many years all around the world, and they're very willing to help newcomers, and they've shared their patterns. These groups gave me inspiration. Finally, angel wear was taking shape in my mind. I'm now looking for volunteers to sew the gowns, sew them back up after I've torn them apart, and they can be donated to local hospitals and given free to parents dealing with the loss of a child. The wedding dresses provide us with the basic material and beautiful lace accents to create the gowns for these little angels. If you have a wedding dress and you'd like to donate, please see me. Statistics say that 20,000 babies are stillborn every year. For parents who want to bury their little one, take a picture, or even take this gown home, it's hard to find clothes small enough. Babies smaller than 1 pound are too small for the gowns, so little wraps are knitted or crocheted to accommodate their tiny bodies. A big thank you to the Perimeter Knitting Group this week for their generous donation, so we now have yarn to give to anybody who would like to donate their talents to create these babies' tiny items. A few months ago, I was introduced to Kathy Bogardus, and for some reason, within 5 minutes of meeting her, I was telling her about my interest in this ministry to convert wedding dresses into bereavement gowns. Another God moment, I'm sure. She's now introduced me to several people, and they've been a tremendous assistance. Perimeter's women's ministry and community outreach are now on board with this ministry, and Kathy continues to provide much-needed encouragement. To give this ministry life, we need volunteer seamstresses who can assemble the gowns. We need volunteers who can knit or crochet to make hats and wraps for the babies too tiny for the gowns. We need contacts at various hospitals, birthing centers, bereavement coordinators, NICU supervisors, and we need donations for things that we don't have already. Some of those things are small, but it'll make a difference. We need yarn, we need lining for the gowns, we need Velcro, bags to distribute them, etc. We already have an open door into Northside Forsyth NICU. They're ready for their first batch of gowns. We've already made the first step out to a hospital, so it's very encouraging. I have a sample of the gowns and wraps for you to see today. They're at the back before you leave. And if you're interested in volunteering your talents, I have some samples for you to take with you to give it a try. You can speak to either me or my right hand, Kathy, at the back of the room. And again, thank you for having me and allowing me to share my ministry this morning.
Thank you very much. Let's pray. You've given us a lot to think about this day, Lord. Interestingly, the overlap of preparing and honoring the dead is an important topic for us to consider. A lot of us like to whistle past the graveyard. There was an interesting line in the movie Gladiator when the one guy turns to the other and he says, death smiles at us all someday. We're not afraid of that, Lord. We're looking forward to being with you. It's how we get there that gets gives us a little concern. But in all of this, Lord, in all of this, you reign supreme. You are the God of the universe. And it is to you that we owe our more than allegiance and respect. It's our worship and our awe. We are delighted that you gave us the speakers that you gave us today. We thank you for the things that we will carry away in our head and our heart and find application for. I imagine there are a number of people here who still have wedding gowns in the attic. There's an opportunity to put them to further use. So, Lord, thank you for the community of faith that you have placed us in this morning. As we leave here and go to service, allow us to carry in our hearts the message that you want us to take forward from today. And may we, through your Holy Spirit, have the wisdom and the courage to step forward and do what you're asking us to do. In the holy name of Jesus, we give you thanks as we serve you this day. Amen.